the vast majority of people never change a default. My favorite example of this is your Wi-Fi router password. You probably didn't change it. So what happens anytime a friend or a guest comes over? You go to the router and you look up the 16-character password that Verizon or Xfinity set for you, and you tell them what it is, or maybe you wrote it down somewhere or took a picture of it. You could also take 5 minutes, log in and change that to something that you can remember, but we just don't do that.
Welcome to the SMB Tech Innovators Podcast, powered by Gusto. On this show, we explore the intersection of fintech, vertical SaaS, and how software combats the rising complexity of running a business. Our goal is to share stories, advice, and best practices from the leaders and investors behind today's cutting-edge platforms. This episode of the SMB Tech Innovators Podcast is brought to you by Gusto Embedded. Gusto has spent a decade building and testing its payroll, tax filing, and compliance infrastructure, which is available as a robust set of APIs so you can develop custom-tailored payroll solutions. For more information, go to embedded.gusto.com. Here's your host, Brian Bush.
On this episode of the SMB Tech Innovators Podcast, my guest is John Shapiro, Chief Product Officer and Chief Technology Officer at Lightspeed, a unified point of sale and payments platform powering some of the world's best businesses. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's dive right in. You've had a very extensive career in tech. Could you tell the audience just a bit more about your background and the journey that led you to your current role with Lightspeed?
I'd be happy to. Maybe I'll start by saying, and hopefully this makes sense as we go through it, because as you look back on my career and the different decisions and points I made, it seems like a very natural, intentional path. And when I think about that, what often runs through my head is the Steve Jobs commencement speech. He was actually my commencement speaker. I had the privilege of being in that audience at Stanford when he gave his commencement speech. At the time, it's like there's this guy on stage talking about dying. That doesn't sound like what you want to hear when you're graduating college. And it's only now looking back in retrospect that you realize that it was one of the profound best speeches, certainly in a while. And kind of that point around like you can connect the dots looking backwards, you can't connect the dots looking forwards. That very much applies to how I think about it. Because I started on the engineering side. I did a CS degree. I was one of those kids who knew exactly what I was going to major in. I'd been tinkering with computers ever since I was young. It was going to be CS and computer science, and that was going to be my degree. What I realized pretty quickly and pretty early on was that what energized me most was deploying technology to solve customer problems, rather than wrangling with those deep technical challenges myself. So as part of my undergrad, I also took a lot of psychology classes because also very fascinated about how we make decisions. Like, why do we make the decisions that we do? Behavioral economics ended up being something I really enjoyed because we're not rational people. As much as we like to think that we are, we're not. And then kind of led after a brief stint at Google and IBM on the software engineering side, that kind of exploration led me to get an MBA. That was my first journey to the East Coast. I did that in Boston. I was always intent to go back to tech, and the Bay Area was a great place to do that. So I ended up coming back and doing a business operations and a chief of staff role at Adobe, where I got to see how large organizations are managed and run at scale, working for the two leaders of the business unit, the developer business unit, where we were helping developers build out web content back when Flash was a thing. Steve Jobs plays a little bit of a recurring theme here because he, with a note, a very public note, killed Flash when he said Apple would never support it on the iPhone. Obviously, for Adobe, it was a small part of the business because much of the revenue was coming from Creative Suite, and got a chance to really be early and be essentially the first product manager to help figure out there's a cloud thing happening. It's 2008, 2009. SaaS in the cloud seems like it's a thing. What should Adobe do to compete there and to have a product and an offering and a solution there, which led to Creative Cloud and a big shift from desktop software to cloud. Got to also work with a lot of the lean startup, kind of early lean startup movement. We were partnering with Eric Ries at Adobe and being one of the sponsors of some of those early conferences. Scott Cook at Intuit. That ended up leading to a path around working at Intuit and being responsible for first growth at QuickBooks, then QuickBooks capabilities, and really creating tools and capabilities for SMBs to manage and run their businesses. Around that time, got asked to take on the payments product and payments business, which was invoicing payments, mobile payments, and also outbound payments and point of sale. Back to the connecting the dots going forward, there's a thread that will end up leading me to Lightspeed. and then came back and was responsible for Intuit's overall QuickBooks platform worldwide, serving at the time about 2.5 million small businesses, growing about from about 400,000 or so by the time from a time I started to the time ended up leaving. And that leaving was making it back to the East Coast. I'm now based outside of Boston. The move to the East Coast was to join Wayfair. Had a chance at Wayfair to work first for a couple of years on the consumer side, helping consumers pick out items for their home. And when you're talking about big, bulky, expensive things that you're going to buy online, we worked a lot on capabilities and tools to give them the confidence to pull the trigger on that purchase. And then I spent about a couple of years on the supplier side, because Wayfair is a two-sided platform where you have consumers and you have the suppliers who want to connect with and sell to those consumers. So building out the product and capability for the suppliers to manage their business on Wayfair. So as you then think about Lightspeed on the retail side, because Lightspeed has two parts to our business. We have a retail side and a restaurant side. And on the retail side, we have three components. We have in-store point of sale, we have e-commerce, and we have B2B and brand facing capabilities. So as you look at and look across my experiences, I ended up being a really good fit for that retail piece, because between Wayfair and Intuit and some of my roles, beyond just the broader product building technical capabilities, there's a lot of very relevant domain expertise that I was bringing. And then as I joined, I've now had the opportunity to take on the full CPTO role and be responsible and accountable for our full product portfolio.
Very impressive resume aside. I love the way that you started that and that idea of deploying technology to solve customer problems. I think it's easy for folks in tech to get wrapped around the axle on the tech itself. It's not just deploying it to solve problems. It's trying to do it in a way that's a little bit different. So you gave a great overview, high level, admittedly, about who Lightspeed is or what the platform is. What sets you apart?
What sets Lightspeed apart is that we really focus on complex in-store workflows, meaning the merchants who we serve, they're ambitious entrepreneurs, multi-location often. They've gotten to the point where they are outgrowing the typical solutions. Oftentimes, and sometimes that's paper and pen. There's a lot to think about when I say paper and pen, Excel or spreadsheets or some of those kinds of things. Sometimes, old school physical registers where you kind of press the button and it dings and opens up. So when we come in, is their business is looking to streamline their operations. They need to do more with less because finding staff can be tricky and hard. And what Lightspeed has really focused on is deeply understanding what happens in a restaurant, what happens in a retail store, and how do we improve and maximize the value that they can get out of a point of sale solution, whether that's front of house, back of house, front office, back office, depending on if you're looking at a restaurant or retailer. There's just a lot of complexity and in-store physicality that we understand, we wrangle with, and we do our best to alleviate the small businesses from having to think about it.
So let's double click on that, because I think that idea of complex workflows, this is a topic that comes up all the time, I think, around the vertical SaaS players. Because everybody's trying to figure out how do you strike that balance between a purpose-built solution, but also giving users or different businesses the flexibility to manage those different but still complex workflows. And I think when I look at Lightspeed, the breadth of solutions you offer is very impressive, from the website, sales and marketing side, so growing the business, operations, T-sheets, point of sale, obviously, but then some back office pieces, inventory management, the capital product. I know you all talk a lot about solving real problems for customers. How do you think about striking that balance? How do you ensure that your all-in-one solution, so to speak, connects the dots for customers in a way that still allows them the flexibility or the customization that they need to match their specific but still complex workflow?
Yeah, this is, if there was an easy answer, then we'd all be crushing it when we need to be on these podcasts and learning from each other and all that. I think the answer is you have to find the middle ground. Because if you have something that is very easy to use, often that comes at the expense of being capable and being flexible. On the other hand, we've all gone into, whether it's an ERP or enterprise grade solution, and be like, oh my God, this seems like it does everything, but like trying to figure it out is going to take a whole implementation team and a customer success team and all of that. And when you're a small business or when you're a merchant, that's not something you want to have to go through and have to figure out. So I think it's very much about both finding that balance and thinking about defaults. Because the data that we have, and it shouldn't come as a surprise, but the vast majority of people never change a default. My favorite example of this is your Wi-Fi router password. You probably didn't change it. So what happens anytime a friend or a guest comes over? you go to the router and you look up the 16 character password that Verizon or Xfinity set for you, and you tell them what it is, or maybe you wrote it down somewhere or took a picture of it. You could also take 5 minutes, log in and change that to something that you can remember, but we just don't do that. So that gets to that point of defaults are really important. So when we have product reviews or when we're talking about product capabilities, we think about both how do you build out the robust set of features and experiences to solve a particular problem or a particular use case for a customer, but then also how do you set the defaults to make it as easy as feasible to get up and running while still allowing people to learn about and explore and go deeper into the more complex functionality? Because that's the flip side of the problem, that if you make the defaults so easy that no one knows that you can change it or things to change it or things to know that they can get more functionality by just going a little bit deeper under the hood, then they won't know. And then they'll ask a favorite feature request or least favorite feature request for a product manager is a thing your product already does. Sales, what do you mean you need X, Y, or Z feature? Or a customer, like, if only you should just go use this. And that's an indication that the product failed to be easy to use enough and easy to let onboard to enough to be able to be self-explanatory.
So maybe a double click there too. Would you try to change that default number? And what I mean by that is, would you and are you proactively trying to encourage more customers to change those defaults? Would that be a metric in some sense that you would look to in terms of, hey, we think that this means folks are finding the full functionality to meet their needs or are customizing the platform in a way? Or do you think that's something that's more just human nature? That's not a metric that you should look to. It's not something you should try and change. It really is just part of working in software.
I think it's a little bit of both. I think if finding the right balance where if you're having everyone have to go in and change everything, then the default wasn't good enough. On the other hand, if no one is ever going in or exploring or using your deeper functionality, then you might as well not have built it. So I think it's a little bit of ensuring that for the people who need it, they're able to discover it. But many or most people in most cases are well served by the defaults. I would say something that we see because we do work with more complex merchants is that there's always a role and a hand-in-hand kind of role of how product works with go-to-market and sales and customer success, where we have the advantage of having robust sales teams and robust account managers and launch managers who partner with and work with merchants depending on their size. So if you're someone who is selling $500,000 a year and you might have a fairly straightforward use case, you can be up and running on your own. If you're a franchisee and maybe you're deploying this across 5, 10, 15 locations, which some of our customers do, then you're going to need some more handholding and we can really gear that product for you. Beyond just the product speaking for itself, there's also an element of being more tailored and more personalized in how you go to market.
And I love that comment. I think we often see, especially earlier stage startups, thinking that, hey, especially maybe with embedded fintech features, it's going to be fully self-serve. Folks are going to find it in product. Like, we don't need sales. We don't need to think about that holistic experience. And I think what you're saying is, hey, sellers are part of this. Account managers are part of this. Think holistically about that user experience. Maybe the next question, John, as you think, this can either be roadmap, really sequencing from products, but when you're adding something on, how do you think about or decide where you have, call it a right to win and where you don't? How do you think about what's next that you want to add to that already broad solution suite?
I think a lot of it comes down to talking to your customers. What are they expecting you to have that you might not? Versus as you're talking about them and maybe sharing some prototypes or just even having kind of ethnographic style interviews with them where you're watching them work and maybe talking about or asking about what they're working on, you can get a pretty good sense for would they consider your company or your brand as something that they would look to solve that problem. And by the way, that changes over time too. And an example I like to use here is by the time Apple dropped Apple Computer or the word computer from their name, this was, forget exactly, but probably around 2010, maybe 2011 to the iPhone era. And when they did, everyone's like, oh yeah, I guess they make computers too, but clearly thinking about them for iPhones and iPads and the broader ecosystem that they'd built out at that point. And I think on the flip side is you have Netflix. When Netflix went and tried to spin apart the DVD business and the streaming business, and I think it was Quixtar maybe was it that what they'd come up with for the DVD business name. It was this big uproar and they had to go back to it because just DVD and Netflix was so ingrained in people's heads that they couldn't get past that. And funny enough, had they just waited another, 2, 3, 4 years to do that, people would have been like, Oh, yeah. I guess Netflix does send DVDs. I haven't gotten one in years, but I suppose that's a thing. How quaint. Good for them to offload that part of the business. So I think there's a lot of how do your customers perceive you? Where do they expect you to play? And what kind of what is just very complementary to what they're using you for? And then over time, you can extend on that and build on it. And again, it's in this case, it's probably product working with marketing, because as you can imagine, it's not just what the product does, but also how you tell your story, how you think about your brand, how your customers think about your brand.
I do love it when guests just bring us back to the absolute basics, as you said, listening to customers. And the reason I'm asking, John, embedded fintech, as we mentioned already, but it's a theme that comes up frequently, and I know it's top of mind for a lot of our listeners. Before we hit record, you mentioned that with some of the, say, the capital product, you all do things just a little bit differently than maybe the status quo. Don't need to get into details necessarily, but really what I want to understand is, how do you think about where to partner, where to build in-house, and some of the technical challenges that come up as you layer on not just a new technology product, but it's a financial services product as well?
Yeah. So I think it's a great example. And there's a broader question that we chatted about in that context, a little bit of like build by partner. It's our favorite. As technologists, we love to build. And the default is let's go build shit because it's fun and it's exciting and you have it. You can make it work exactly the way you want to. The downside is it always takes longer to build than you think. Like I've not yet encountered a team that will say, this thing's going to take 2 months to do. And you sit here 2 months later and it's done. There's always complexity that you don't know or understand, or the thing that you build is a very rudimentary product and you need to take time to go from MVP to MLP, minimal lovable product or functional or whatever, however you want to think about it. The flip side a little bit is oftentimes when you think about buy, that's usually an acquisition question, and integrating always takes longer than you expect it to. It's, oh, these are totally complementary. They do ABC, we do XYZ. It's just going to come together and
it's going to be great.
It's going to be great. And the technical implementation will be straightforward and simple. And same thing, it always takes longer to recognize that value. And partner or use platforms is somewhere in the middle. And all three of those, I would say, have a role as you think about your product portfolio. In our particular case with Capital, what we wanted to do is what we heard from our customers is they see us as a business partner. They don't just see us as a software provider or point of sale provider. They see us especially as we help them with payments and take more and more of their payments complexity off of their plate. The next natural place is I'd like to get some more money faster and maybe ahead of when my customers are paying me for it. And that's where the Capital product comes into play with merchant cash advances. And our view was, let's validate the market before we go spend a lot of time working with an embedded fintech player or really building out those capabilities. Let's validate and make sure that what customers say and what customers do is often different. So let's get some products out to market in an experimental way and then in a growth kind of way to validate that they actually want this. So that was kind of one angle to it. And then the other angle to it is in a lot of fintech, the person who takes on the risk and the person who's able to manage that risk gets a lot of the financial outcome of it. And that's no different in Capital. And I think we're in a luxurious spot where we have a lot of that deep risk capability and experience in-house. We also have a robust balance sheet where at least for a little while, and we've shared that we are doing these cash advances off of our balance sheet at the moment. At some point, as we continue to grow, we'll work with partners and we'll kind of extend our offering. But for now, we have that cash to be able to advance it. We have the expertise to be building out and managing the risk and have built out that product.
I appreciate that. Maybe a double click. Did you consider, you mentioned validating the products in market or the demand from your user base, your merchant base. Did you think about trying to test initially with just referrals or linking out to some other, say, lender site in this case? And the reason I'm asking, I feel like that's a question that comes up frequently with other embedded fintech products. What's the minimum product I need to build to test demand for my users, to really know and get signal, is this something my customers want or not? And again, aside from the interviews that we hope everybody is doing.
Yeah. And to be explicit, we did do that. Like as you think about payments, like we have now invested quite a bit in our payment capabilities and integrated payments, but we started with very much a referral style model where we worked with different payment providers around the world to validate that payments and integrated payments are going to be valuable. In that particular case, we saw more and more that it wasn't just about being able to take the payment. It's about not having to think about the payment part and the point of sale part as separate, and to really embed payments into our product experience for our customers. We ended up deciding then to invest and build out our payments capabilities and Now we offer that natively and directly. And it was a bit of a similar approach where by the time we got to this capital process that I described, we had gone through a little bit of that referral and validation, oftentimes across a number of places on our ecosystem, meaning we have an API. We oftentimes have third parties who seek us out or we work with to build some of those light data connectivity integrations. As we see customer interest and customer demand around those, then we'll invest in those capabilities more and deeper integrations and sometimes directly into the UI or sometimes directly in a way that we might sell a third party and then get our customers connected to them.
I appreciate you sharing. Maybe take a small step back. You mentioned build by partner. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about how you think about the NuORDER acquisition, where that fits in your strategy. And so please first tell listeners briefly who NuORDER is. And then I'm curious, I think the heart of the question is, do you see this as an extension of, call it the operational solution? Or are you moving into, I don't know if I would call it a new, but moving more into let's be a marketplace?
So NuORDER is probably the best way to describe it is it's a wholesale selling platform. And as we think about that, and we coined it broadly as a supplier network, because if you think about most of the interactions that historically and prior to NuORDER that Lightspeed has had is we have merchants. Those merchants are SMB or light mid-market in size, and then they sell to consumers or sometimes other businesses. What exists also is the entire procurement problem, meaning as a small business, one of your biggest challenges is on the retail side is to know how much inventory to stock. If you're not stocking enough, then you miss out on sales. A customer shows up and you don't have the t-shirt in red in their size, or you don't have the bike that they want, and they're going to go elsewhere for it. On the other hand, if you have too much inventory, then that's tying up cash on the shelves. Those might be dollars that you need to make payroll or you want to deploy for other purposes, and or they might not sell. So now you might be at the end of a season and you have a bunch of beach umbrellas or whatever it might be that you're selling. And it's October in Boston and no one's buying beach umbrellas. So like you have to dramatically reduce pricing or promote it to get it out the door. And that's going to hit your bottom lines as well. So that's a real challenge and problem. Even getting access sometimes to inventory from the brands that you want to sell in a number of categories, there's marquee brands that you want to be able to sell their products, and getting connected to them is not easy for a small business merchant. So that's the small business side or the merchant side of the problem. On the other side, maybe you're a Tommy Bahama or Ralph Lauren or a large brand. You are probably, and certainly prior to NuORDER or platforms like it, using a very antiquated system of wholesaling, meaning you'll sell some direct to consumer, but you'll also have a vibrant wholesale business of selling to others who in turn sell to your consumers. And you'll be selling that through sending emailing spreadsheets back and forth will often be what you're using. So NuORDER came about to modernize that whole wholesaling process. That's a bit of a mouthful. And also realize that there were a number of enterprise retailers, Nordstrom's, Macy's, Saks, who have a similar assortment problem where they want to, ahead of a season, make sure that they have the right lineups and the right stores for their customers. So what it did is it built out a wholesale platform for the brands that we're talking about, a enterprise retail platform for those large retailers, and help connect those. And what Lightspeed looked at and said is that same problem exists for small businesses. And we believe we can deliver value for the small businesses by helping them get the right inventory. We believe we can help brands by getting them connected into those small businesses, and ended up acquiring NuORDER. Because back to that question, that build by partner question, we determined that not only is this a valuable capability that we can offer, but it also gives us a competitive advantage. That if you think about a small business considering a point of sale, something we've heard a lot and has been proven out is that they're much more likely and much more excited to go with a point of sale that has access to all the brands that they're buying from. And one data point here is a purchase order that a small business creates, if they're buying from a NuORDER brand and end up processing it through NuORDER, it saves them 90 minutes of just data entry time. That is massive when you think about, and some of these might have dozens or hundreds of purchase orders per month, per year. So it's a very substantial time savings that we can deliver. And we determined that the best way to do that is by having that through an acquisition and having that capability and all of those brands and all of those enterprise retailers part of the Lightspeed platform as well.
Yeah. Seems like an incredible way to just solve more customer pain. And it actually, I feel like it may be a contrast, but the last topic I want to pick your brain about a bit is where you see machine learning and AI showing up in your product roadmap or in the product experience itself. And the reason I say it's a contrast, it almost feels like that 90 minutes time saving, the spreadsheets, it's such a manual sort of almost rudimentary sort of problem, but very persistent, as you pointed out, and very much a pain point for these small businesses. So where, like on the very other end of the spectrum, the most advanced technology we're seeing these days, where do you see it really showing up and solving pain for customers?
It can be a fun dichotomy sometimes when one day you're talking about how do you replace a spreadsheet and the next day you're talking about deploying Gen AI or machine learning to automate and streamline procurement flows. And I think they ironically go hand in hand because these are a way to think about it is large companies, large competitors. Think about the big box retailers. They have large tech teams. They can deploy. They can think about AI. They can do their own machine learning model creation and build that out. Small business retailers can't. And something that I really enjoy about having a number of times in my career, but especially now at Lightspeed, is that we are really helping the small businesses and the merchants that who we serve to be competitive with think about the Main Street merchant being as competitive as someone who has hundreds of thousands of dollars of R&D spend that they're deploying. And AI and machine learning is a great example of that. One place we're doing that is inventory forecasting. We talk a lot about procurement and how do you decide and know how much to buy? One example is if you want to spend all day in a spreadsheet, you could probably have a pretty good way to estimate or figure that out. Our first start was our merchants don't want to be spending all day in a spreadsheet. Can we give them a recommendation and say, these are how many sales you might have missed out on because you're out of stock based on seasonality or time of year? This is how much you should be buying. So I think that's one good example. It goes hand in hand into that supplier network piece and the new order side. Where now we're also working to recommend to brands to say, hey, Brian's t-shirt shop hasn't ordered from you in a while, and they're probably running low on this particular style or color. You should reach out to them. That'd be a good wholesale order to make you happy and to make Brian happy because he probably didn't think to or forgot. And now this will help make sure he's got product for his customers. So I think that's one. And to kind of extend it more broadly around insights, that's what we do on the restaurant side as well. We have something we call the Magic Quadrant. And not only is that looking at your own kind of historic sales, it's also looking at what are the products that are bringing your diners again and again. Because you know it's easy to say, this thing sold well. That's probably not a dish you want to keep on your menu. Correlate your customer analytics that we're able to provide you, your menu information, and your sales. We're able to be a really trusted advisor to restaurateurs to help them figure out what are the products that should be more prominent on their menus? What are the products that maybe they should revisit or rethink? So those are a few examples. And then obviously no conversation around AI would be complete without Gen AI, which is the topic of the day. Mm-hmm. And we've been able to leverage that quite productively to make it a lot easier, for example, to set up our product. We talked a bit about how do you find that right balance on defaults and easy to use versus capable. Our restaurant product is our, in this case, it's our case series product. It's quite robust. But what we heard from some customers is that it might not be as easy to get up and running as they want it to be and we want it to be. So we used AI to help understand and help work them through what settings they should pick and how to get up and running and saw some nice onboarding time improvement and time savings out of that. And then more recently released the ability to edit imagery in our e-commerce product. Because you can imagine that most small businesses don't have photo studios that they're using to take high quality shots of their inventory and their products they're selling. And now they don't need to. Now they can use an iPhone, snap a photo of a product, jump into our experience and use AI to remove backgrounds or create new backgrounds and just really up-level the experience they're giving to their customers.
Yeah. Incredible examples. And thank you for sharing a little bit more detail there. Although I feel like what I need to point out is going back, and I love how the greats always go back to just the core basics, but hey, at the end of the day, it's about keeping small businesses competitive, helping them compete with the big guys. It just resonates very much with the mission, how we think about things at Gusto. So I appreciate that point. Maybe lastly, John, before we let you go, there are a number of listeners out there who want to have the type of impact that you have had through your career and that you're having with Lightspeed now. What advice would you offer to the next generation of product leaders? Or what are the questions that you get asked all the time and you want to broadcast to a slightly larger audience?
I think built into that is a little bit of like, how do I grow in my career as a product manager? And I think one example would be to think about, apply a lot of the same capabilities that you are using to serve your customers as a product manager and think about that internally as well, which is in an organization. A couple of ways I frame it is first, stop listening to your boss is my glib way of putting that in, or don't listen to your CEO. Because we've all been on the receiving side of someone shows up and someone very senior shows up and says, we should do this. And maybe the run of the mill response is like, great, we'll do that. or no, like, I don't want to do that. That's a dumb idea. And neither of those, I think, are particularly productive versus seeking to understand, like, why are you suggesting that we do this? What's the problem that you're trying to solve? If it's a requesting a product feature, what is your belief or your assumption around a customer experience or customer opportunity that you might have? If it's about an internal process or approach, what is the problem that you're trying to solve? And we all like to speak in solutions. It's easy. We should do this. And in reality, what is really valuable, both in product building and in navigating your career, is being able to listen past that solution and understand the underlying problem and then go solve that problem. Because usually the solution that was first proposed or requested is not the best solution. And you are able to, by understanding the problem, come up with a better solution and get to a better outcome. And as you do that over and over, you'll have great impact for customers. You'll build a reputation internally across your team as someone who gets it and who can be a good sounding board. And that will serve you well to scale your impact over time by taking on reports or just growing as an IC, kind of on an IC track, and having bigger and broader impact that then gets rewarded with more opportunities.
John, if you ever write a book, and I'm not suggesting you do, but I hope the title is Don't Listen to Your Boss.
It's a blog post, at least, that remains unwritten. But maybe after this conversation, I'll go write that.
I love it. John, thank you so much for joining us today and sharing some of your insights. Before we wrap up, if folks have questions or want to go deeper on anything that we discussed, what's the best way for them to connect with you?
LinkedIn is probably the best across the web for me. Just linkedin.com/in/JohnShapiro, JohnShapiro.
Fantastic. We'll make sure to link to that in the show notes for folks as well. John, thank you again for your time today.
Thanks so much for having me. Enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks again for tuning into this episode of the SMB Tech Innovators Podcast. We'll make sure to link to any resources that were mentioned in today's show in the show notes. Please also feel free to leave us a review wherever you listen to your podcast or to connect with the Gusto Embedded team via LinkedIn. In particular, we'd love to hear any future guests you'd like us to have on the show. Thanks again for listening, and keep a lookout for the next episode.